Well, good evening, everyone. Happy Shabbat to one and all. My pleasure to be with you. I'm Craig. We have the Kirkster, Captain Kirk. We have James T. With us. I guess is the old captain of the Enterprise, and we have the Larianator. Hi, fellas.
Hello. Hey,
how's it going?
Oh, you know, I've had better days. Many of you know, I'm kicking myself from here to the sidewalk and back. I violated one of my cardinal rules yesterday, and paid a heck of a price. I think I had sent to a number of you about 3 weeks ago a series of rants. It was like 12 emails from a fellow that, oh my, was just calling me every dastardly name under the book, and you know, and his summations of yada yada and the like were painful to look at. And I read about the three sentences and said, this is way beyond me. And I passed it on to four or five of you. And I said, you know, I'm going to pass on this. I don't think I've got anything to say. But, you know, maybe you guys know how to engage, and feel free to respond. I don't think anybody did. And then this fellow, earlier this week, he sent me two very apologetic letters. I didn't care if he apologized. I don't. I'm like all the rest of you. I do not care what somebody says about me. It is absolutely irrelevant. Now, that is not totally true. If somebody that knows me, if one of you guys who actually knows me, who I'm respecting, then if you said that, you know, I'm a lying scumbag, and that having read what I've written, that it's a bunch of trash, you know, I would get my attention. I would be bothered by that. But somebody I don't know that hasn't really read anything I would say, I don't care what they say. But anyway, he was very apologetic, and he said, give me a second chance. He wrote two letters like that. And I had made a hard, fast rule that don't ever engage with somebody who shows signs of mental illness. Because if you do, then you may be the person that pushes them over the edge. And that you'll end up getting blamed because they might do something horrible. And so I particularly with Muslims, I would never push their buttons after a while. I just stopped. And I haven't been to the Prophet of Doom site and answered emails probably in 5 years. Who knows how many death threats and rants there are there. They don't bother me, though, because I don't read them. But anyway, I responded to this guy. And, you know, many
I saw the book he wrote.
Yeah, well, okay. So anyway, I responded and basically said, you know, there's only one thing I can do advice for you, and that is that I would read what God had to say, and I would stop writing. Just do those things. I can tell you that these are the books that I've written. This is what I know. I'm offering them free. I'll tell you what each of the books says. If I were you, and it's going to take, you know, it'd take you 150 hours to read yada yada, I just start at the beginning and go to the end. And then, you know, I'd read Introduction to God next. That'll take you about 75 to 100 hours. And then I'd go to Questioning Paul, and that'll take you about 75 hours. And just go through it methodically. And when you're done, I'll send you observations for our time. But please, don't write me anymore. Just read. And, you know, I'm hopeful that what God says will resonate with you and make a difference. So I sent that off. And I sent that reply to a number of you. And oh, my goodness, I knew. You know, if I could be successful two-thirds of the time, I could make tens of millions of dollars as a major league hitter. But, you know, two-thirds right doesn't get you anywhere in life. I sent him the right message for the right reason. But he was the wrong person to send it to. He came back with expletives in every other word, and I'm going to take my own life, and I don't deserve to live, and I want to go kill myself. And, you know, and it was just, whoa, oh my goodness. So I sent it to a number of you and said, what would you do? Do you respond? Do you ignore it? And I got about 50-50 from you. I thought about it for a while, and I sent him basically a letter that said, listen, there's nothing I can do to help you. What I encourage you to do, which was to read what Yahweh has to say to uphold life, was the right advice. And all I can do is encourage you to do that. But I don't have the skill set, I don't have the aptitude, I don't have the inclination, I don't have the ability, I don't have the training. There is no part of me that is prepared to help you where you are now. And you need help. I'm just not the right person. So please don't write me again. I wish you all the best. I hope you do consider what Yahweh has to say. And I sent that to him this morning. I actually got a reply back from him. Said, I'm so sorry. And I need to know where your translation is of the Torah. Could you please send it to me? It's like he never processed anything I sent. So I just sent him the links to each of the books and attachments, what I have written, and that's it. I only share this with you because the only reason I responded to him really was that having done the show and listened to you all, I know that every one of you has been in that position before where somebody has asked for insights. You sensed it was going to be a problem, but you shared them anyway. It blew up in your face. And I just wanted to share, sometimes the best thing to do is to say, I was wrong. I did the right thing for the right reason with the wrong person. I should not have done it. And I just going to share that with you in that I think that knowing that I was pretty, prepared that this was the wrong thing to do. I think with family, that's what you do. So it had that benefit. But, oh, my goodness. That was bad. There's another thing that happened today. I'll share this, and then we'll move on. But the other was that Jim Doyle, who was the original administrator of the Yadia Forum, and the guy that actually started me doing radio, Jim had sent me the story of what happened in Nice. And it was obvious that the truck was to blame, and the problem is we have too many trucks in this world, and we need to come up with truck legislation. And of course, that's what I told him immediately. No, actually, I wrote him a long letter. I didn't tell him anything he didn't already know. But I wrote him a letter, and I sent that letter to a number of y'all, and including a one talk radio host who is Louis Free. And Louis Free called me and said, "Would you come on the show and read that letter to me today? I want to post the letter. I want you to read it for me." And I did. I will. I'd like to read through the letter quickly because I think it correctly assesses where we are and why it will and why I have chosen to do nothing more than what we're doing tonight. Let me share this with you. It says,
"Please,
this attack in Nice, one in a long series of such attacks, perpetrated by men named Muhammad, following the example of Muhammad and the orders of his one of these God Allah, and the response to it, demonstrates that mankind is destined to be deceived and to die. Collectively and principally as a result of socialist secular humanism, the Western world has lost the ability to think and to understand, and thus to be judgmental and moral. Rational thought is based upon making connections, bein in Hebrew, leading to mishpat, the exercise of good judgment. The common denominator in 99.9% of terrorist attacks around the world is Islam. Not radical Islam, but fundamentalist Islam as it was presented by Muhammad in the Quran and Hadith, as it was lived by Muhammad. To ignore or reject the only common denominator is to be ignorant and irrational, both of which are destructive and deadly. To be unaware of the Quran's mandate to engage in jihad, to fight and kill all non-Muslims, and to be aware of the fact that Muhammad was a ruthless terrorist is inexcusable today. The consequence is what we are witnessing. Orlando was a prime example. Guns were blamed. Homophobia was blamed. Extremism was blamed. A lone wolf was blamed. Even hate was blamed. But not Islam. Where I come from, we have a word for that. Stupid. Ignorance is not bliss. It is destructive and deadly. Unfortunately, this is all going to get much worse. A death cult has been deemed acceptable by the world's leaders, and therefore Muslims will continue to kill until there is no one left to kill. This has never been about Al-Qaeda. This is not about the Islamic State. It is about Islam. Until and unless world leaders, the media, the military, intelligence agencies, police departments, and the departments of justice collectively shed their self-imposed ignorance of Muhammad, the Quran, and Hadith, and condemn the religion of Islam as a death cult, as a declaration of war against all humankind, and then outlaw the terrorist manifesto of Islam, expel Muslims, isolate Muslims to their countries, stop selling weapons to Muslims, and withdraw from all Islamic majority countries. Islamic terrorism will continue unabated, ultimately leading to World War III. We will witness the death of not scores of people, not hundreds or thousands of people, not even millions of people, but billions will die. During its first 100 years, Muslims murdered nearly half of the world's population, perpetrating the greatest genocide in world history in Arabia, Persia, India, throughout the Middle East, Northern Africa, Byzantium, and across Southern Europe. Islam's last 100 years will be equally deadly as a percentage of the world's population, but much worse than body count. We have no one to blame but ourselves. Mankind needs to learn the value of hating. And it needs to know what to hate, why hate is a good thing, and it needs to learn what to hate. Coming to hate the likes of Islam is not only moral and beneficial, but also logical and compassionate. That is what I sense and what I had a chance to share on the Louis Free Show today. My parting comment for you all is that I tried. I failed. Now, if the mission is defined as having made a difference with your message, then I was an absolute and total failure. I never sensed, though, that was the mission that Yahweh wants to accomplish. I sensed the mission that he wanted to accomplish was simply to make the truth known, to leave people without excuse. And if that is the case, and I think it is, then we succeeded. We did exactly what we set out to do. But it is like his Torah. Yahweh did not set out to change the world, to make a difference collectively in the world with his Torah. He made it available to share the truth, to convey the truth, to make the truth available. Therefore, anyone who wants to know the truth about Islam now can read Prophet of Doom. It's all there for them. If they want to know the truth about the living God, they can read his Torah. It's there. God didn't share it to change the world. He shared it to make the truth available for those who are interested in knowing it. I think many of you know that about 6 months ago, I made a profound change in my life. I made the decision that I was wasting my time trying to awaken a comatose world, and that the risks that I was taking to do so were inappropriate. And I stopped. I said, I'm only going to do from this point out that which I enjoy doing. Call it selfish. But I'm going to return to translating and writing and sharing the insights that I glean along the way because I find that fun. I think it is rewarding to those who care to share the experience along with me. And that's what I choose to do. And I came to the conclusion that while it is true that Yahweh has promised to protect me and my family, that protection is requiring something of Him now that I think is way beyond the benefit that it is providing. And let me share what I mean. There's only one thing that God hates more than interfering with free will, and that's failing to honor a promise that He has made. He promised in the 91st Psalm to protect anyone who would do what I did. I read it as personal to me. I think that was right to do. And that is His promise. He has deployed His malach to protect me and my family. But I'm here to tell you, based upon what the world has become, particularly over these last few years, His malach are having to intervene in free will around the world many times a day to honor that promise. I don't think there's enough benefit to put God in that position. So I just stopped. All right, so I've talked a lot. Open to your guys' thoughts, comments, and criticisms, suggestions.
Well, you know, okay,
go ahead.
Just
Kirk,
before we... pops in my mind, two things are related. Yosha said, you know, go out and tell some folks, and if they don't receive you, then kick the dust off your shoes and leave.
Yeah. So, and he did that regularly. Sure. You know, you notice that almost every story, and this is the thing that people miss, almost every story of Yosha addressing people ends in one of two ways. Either him disappearing just to get away from them, because he's had all of them he can possibly take, or him making a comment that says, listen, I don't want to do this. I'm only doing this, what I'm doing you think is just wonderful. It is mundane. I'm only doing this so that you might consider the possibility that if I'm capable of doing this, maybe you'll trust me to do something that's vastly more important. And not heal your body, but heal your soul. Those are his two responses. And, you know, sometimes when people would engage with people and they make a stupid statement, they say, what in the world is wrong with you? You're an absolute moron. So, I think that the example Yosha set for us is the only rational, sane way to respond to all this. You know, you do what you can do, and then you've got to fall back because, oh my. And I got 1/1 billionth of the fortitude that he had. So, you know, I just realized that it isn't worth it anymore.
Yeah, well, I would argue that what you're doing now is more beneficial anyway. I think I get, at least for me, I get more out of reading the stuff you're writing now than listening to commentary on the news and shattering myths or going over stuff we've already went over and shattering myths. So, personally, I find this more beneficial.
I do too.
It's pretty powerful stuff.
And, you know, I think, I translate and I write for myself. I do it. I don't do it for anybody else. I do it for myself. And I find that if I share what I have learned, it makes it even more enjoyable. And so is it selfish? Absolutely. Is it beneficial? Yeah, it's just that it's selfish and beneficial to a smaller group. I think it's okay. You know,
along those lines, look at Yahweh. He's going to come in and stop the World War III.
Yeah.
Go back and play with his family. I mean, that's pretty selfish if you thought about it that way, but, you know, to hear about prioritizing. These are the people who care. These are the people who don't. Who do you want to spend time with?
You know, that's the conclusion I came to. If Yahweh were to slap me across the head, in fact, we had a long talk today. We don't really have, you know, long talks. We mostly do long listens. But we had a long talk today. And, you know, the talk today was over two things, really. One is, if there is something that I am saying, that I have written, that I've, I'm advancing, that is inconsistent with your intent, your message, your plan. Good God, please tell me what it is so that I can correct it. And second, you know, I've moved into selfish mode. I am translating because I enjoy it. I'm pondering what you're saying because I find it stimulating, and I'm back to only sharing what I've learned with a very small group of people. If that's not what you want, you know, if the time comes and you say, you know, we got to go after him again, be blunt. Hit me across the side of the head and say, it's time we go do this again. And, you know, I'll do whatever you want to do. But between now and then, I'm just going to listen to what you have to say and share what I learned from it. That was one of our, now, as I said, we don't have long talks very often. we just basically do long listens. But we had one today.
Before we got on the radio or the show today, I understand that political correctness is deployed, okay, as a tool to dumb people down. I understand that.
Yes.
But
you
I ask thinking, you,
so they're easy to manipulate.
Right, right. And it's sort of a psyop. You're a jerk if you don't go along with political correctness. You're a homophobe, Islamophobe, or whatever phobe you are. I get
right.
that. Okay. But I had a question. And, you know, I mean, just as an example, you know, you've got Turkey falling apart. I mean, clearly that's on the border of Syria. Okay. You had a coup because a guy, the military leaders wanted to remain sectarian, and then the president was clearly leaning towards becoming more Islamic, which is really insane.
There's a coup in Turkey today.
Yeah, right. My sister-in-law just left there. She was flying back from Iran. She was 2 hours ahead of them grounding planes, actually.
Yeah, it was a military coup in Turkey today.
Yeah. As an example, Italy, where tens of thousands of Somalians are being, you know, they're coming in there to, you know, they get there with nothing. They have no skills. They all go on welfare immediately. They bring nothing. They're coming from a society where the pinnacle of society is being a pirate, you know, and they...
It's a small version of what has happened and continues to happen in Minnesota.
Yeah, and Minnesota as well. This would be another example. Now,
yeah,
I don't know if the Western
Minnesota
oligarchs...
has led the crusade to bring Muslim Somalis into...
Right, and there are neighborhoods now threatening to rape women when they come out of their homes and things like this.
Let me interrupt you one second. Did you hear what happened yesterday, speaking of Islamic rape?
No.
Remember about 6 months ago, there was a report out of Germany that thousands of these Muslim immigrants had raped thousands of German women. And it took place in Belgium, it took place in France, it took place on New Year's Eve across Europe. I reported on it at the time. And because I found enough evidence from hospitals and other places to justify it, even though all of the authorities were saying it's not true.
Right.
And
they covered up.
They continued to deny it until yesterday.
Really?
And yesterday they came out and said, and I don't know what was the reason that they finally fessed up, but they came out and said, yeah, it was many thousands of Muslim men raped thousands of European women. And that there is no chance that we're going to be able to prosecute them or hold them accountable, but we in fact can verify this occurred. And what it tells me is this is absolute verification on a global basis that the elitists have decided that they will no longer convey information to the public that is contrary to their agenda, and that they will constantly present misinformation and inaccurate information and incomplete information, and they will continue to do so at an ever-increasing basis. And we're witnessing it in America. You cannot trust anyone today. So that was pretty amazing. Is that correct? Okay, so you're right. They're raping women, and it's happening in large and around all of Europe. That's why Brexit passed. And Germany, of course, is leading the process, but Italy is not far behind.
No, it won't be. No, not the way they're voting them in. But my question to you is, why would the Western oligarchs... look, you got a governor. You got a governor in Minnesota who clearly said, hey, if you guys don't like it, leave New Somalia. I mean, that's what he said to Minnesota?
Yeah, he did. Yeah. Yeah, that's what he said. He said that if you're opposed to this, then you're the problem, and you ought to leave the state. So, you know, if you were raised in third or fourth generation Minnesotan, then according to the governor, it's you that have to leave, and because these Muslims are welcome.
And I'm asking you why. That was my. You said I knew the answer. I'd like to hear the answer.
Why is Islamic immigration being sponsored to the tune of millions per year when it is obviously guaranteed to create universal anarchy and the destruction of those
anarchy. Chaos.
Why it's like the world deciding that the best thing we can do is to bring victims of Ebola into our societies, and then to make certain that they are integrated into your society, so everyone is exposed to Ebola. That's what it's akin to. Why would anyone do that? And I think you all know the answer.
Mm-hmm.
There,
problem solution.
Yeah. Sure. The best way, the easiest way to garner absolute and total control over people is under a situation of anarchy. When anarchy exists, people will gravitate to a dictator. They'll accept a dictator. They will willingly give up all of their freedoms to deal with anarchy. Anarchy is the elixir of power. You know, it was for many, many centuries, Rome was considered a good thing because they prevented rebellion. They prevented anarchy. Now, the way they went about it was draconian. They were heinous in every possible way. And it was the fall of Rome was considered the product of barbarians, when in fact the barbarians were the Romans. The people that finally rose up against them were vastly more civil and moral than the Romans. But throughout history, if you look at, for example, the most recent experience with Hitler in Nazi Germany, it was the anarchy in that country that was the result of the imposition of the Western, particularly Woodrow Wilson's demands after World War I, that pushed Germans into a position where anarchy was inevitable and a dictatorship seemed preferable to those conditions. So, having studied history, today's leading politicians recognize that the fastest path to them having absolute power is anarchy.
Mm-hmm.
Why they're doing that. That's the answer.
Yeah, well, okay. You know, I mean, that's kind of my take, too. I mean, I just, other than that, it didn't make any sense. As it was in the beginning, it'll be in the end. And, you know, in Babylon, the national lunar deity was basically Sin, who is Islam today, and the Catholic Church in Christianity, the lunar deity or yep. solar deity.
The Trinity of the Trinity of Christianity.
Yeah, but you did have the national lunar deity sin, so you know the Pope came out. He outlawed Yahweh's name, which is fine with me in their damn church. I don't care about that, but Allah was fine.
One iota.
No, but Allah's fine. Allah's fine. He said so.
And by the way, that doesn't bother me. You know why that doesn't bother me?
Well, because they're just poison well to begin with. I mean, so what, put a little more poison
in there. Roman Catholic care. Church is, according to Yahweh, the single most destructive and menacing institution in human history.
Yeah, Pergamos, the seat of
do I care what people who God has condemned as being the single most destructive entity in world history? And they make a stupid statement. Is that should that be of concern?
No, it doesn't bother you, of course.
No,
of course not. It's almost humorous at some point. If it wasn't so destructive, it would be. But you know,
yeah,
there's going to be a lot of lives lost. I mean, that's all I know.
I personally think that we are right now on the threshold. Just my gut has told me we know the tribulation is still 10 years away. I just sense that we are on the threshold of a very, very dark and evil period.
Well, there, you have to be right. If you weren't right, there's no way that the beast could come into power. I mean, he does it through economic and militaristic means. It can't come out of nowhere.
Economic collapse, Larry, based upon the fiat money worldwide and the deficit spending, the deficit that exists around the world. Economic collapse could literally occur over a weekend. Worldwide.
Sure.
I mean, it could occur this weekend worldwide. That's the situation we're in. So, you know, I'm not of the conviction that anything has to happen between now and 10 years from now for the Torahless ones to come into power. Literally, economic.
I see what you're saying. They can do it in one day.
Can happen over a weekend, and the rest of it's a laid-out map, which is easy. And this, by the way, I have nothing here. This is not divine inspiration. It's just a gut feeling. I have a gut feeling that it's going to get really bad. And it's going to get really bad over the next year. We'll see if that might... Just a gut instinct, guys. I'm not predicting anything other than just telling you. My gut told me that it was time to step out of the limelight with mm-hmm. Shattering Myths and doing that kind of show, and to hunker down. Just pay attention to what's meaningful and important, because it's going to get nasty.
I believe it.
Yeah. No, it will. I mean, I always felt like they were going to drag it down slowly. You know, just a little here, a little there, a little there. They could do it either which way. And like you said, anarchy is the elixir for, you know, the new power base to come up and go, look, we're here to help you. Why we
can
for you, of course. You know, out of chaos comes control. That is their
motto. You know,
that's
ultimately, it's going to be the realization that money has no value.
Mm-hmm.
Right.
Money's going to have no value. So if you're fabulously rich and money has no value, what do you do?
Matter, is it?
What do you do? The only thing that matters when money no longer matters is power. So their end game, and they're not stupid, their end game is to transition from money-influenced lives to power-influenced
private armies.
Yeah, sure. Yeah, well, yeah, the armies of nations will serve them.
Yeah, sure.
And they don't live there either. I mean, so they don't care what they destroy Paris. They can live anywhere. Oh, yeah, they have homes there.
Well, that's part of their shtick. They don't believe in borders or anything like that because, you know, it's all a very self-centered, self-serving thing. I just wondered your take on it because you know, as I sit there and it doesn't take a rocket scientist. I mean, they don't even have to know what we know about Islam, okay? It doesn't take a rocket scientist to know you don't want Islam in your neighborhood, you know, running the show. You just don't.
Correct. Yeah.
And if people can't figure that out, they're retarded, and I don't care one way or another.
Yeah. I mean, all you have to do is realize that 99.9% of terrorist acts over the last 20 years have been perpetrated by fundamentalist Muslims.
Yeah.
99.9%.
Yeah.
And if you can't make the connection that that is the common denominator and say, you know, Islam, therefore, is counterproductive, we ought not be selling them guns. We ought not be allowing them into this country. We ought not be trying to change their country. This is a serious problem. We just really ought to disassociate from this problem. Then, the hell with you.
You're
just too stupid for thought.
There's another problem, though, see, is that any Westerner should know this. You know, my wife, who comes from Iran, knows this, okay? But it goes deeper than that. I'm saying why the Western public sets back and watches their leaders openly do this, like, say, the governor of Minnesota or Barack Obama or whoever else. Maybe you're in Germany, maybe you're in Italy, it doesn't matter where. Maybe you're in Greece. And they're flooding your countries with these people that are clearly out of control. I mean, they're clearly out of control in England, as an example. And in France, as a total example. You know, all these riots and all this. And yet, the Western oligarchs keep bringing them in, and the Western people do nothing about it.
Can I address that?
You know why people are doing nothing about it?
Okay, go ahead. Tell me.
Well, I can tell you about three or four reasons why it came to be like it is. Certainly in America, if you wanted to destroy America, what they did, they first of all, they broke up the home and made it where we had both parents working, and nobody
they declared the nuclear family.
Nobody married, and both parents working. Right.
Right, and they're, and that's an economic thing too. If they're not both working, then they all suffer. So that takes priority. So now the family is no longer priority. Then they broke up the independent businesses of America because when I grew up, they used to tell you, "Here's the people that employed, and most of them were farmers." That's where I came from. When you own a farm, you're independent. You not only have your own business,
right.
You have your own food source, your own whatever. You can't destroy somebody who's, number one, armed and living on their own business.
That's right.
They don't need you. You know,
right. They went from agricultural to an urban society, and that was done primarily with music and movies.
But that
and
was
so forth.
We not only destroyed the private farm, we as a nation, starting with FDR, villainized and attacked business. Right. So we destroyed the means of production. We destroyed the value of work.
Mm-hmm.
And right after destroying the merit and purpose of a family. So that was one, two. What is three and four then?
Well, three, the thing that for me to get a degree in education and to get certified as, you know, and go through where I could teach in the public school system, I had to take all these courses on Dewey's philosophy of education, which was called experimentalism, and he packaged it as progressive education. Now, if you really break it down, all you have is social secular humanism and their little mantra. And so what they did, now you've destroyed the home, you destroyed the family, you destroyed the businesses, and now you destroyed the mind of the young people. They couldn't get to the old people. They still rather centered. But the young minds start with somebody under five years old, and if you can pick them all the way, man, you got them. And then you go back to
open
now.
That is the third. Now, personally, I think that is the worst of the three that you have mentioned so far. Mm-hmm. But what education has become is the temple of the New World Religion.
Sure.
And educators, teachers, are the priests and the pastors of the New World Religion.
Right.
And so education has become the schools, academia, has become the repository of the most popular religion in the world today, socialist secular humanism. And 100% of those who are involved in it have a loyalty oath to it. You cannot teach unless you are
an
advocate, priest, disciple of this religion, of socialist secular humanism. And it has its own moral code. Its moral code is called political correctness, and everything in its moral code is designed to be the inverse of what Yahweh says we should do. And that moral code and that religion and those temples of the religion, which are schools, and the ministers of that religion, which are teachers, because of public education, have indoctrinated two generations now on their religion to the point where today it is less than 1 in 100,000 people, maybe as few as 1 in 1,000,000, that is capable of thinking. And I witness it every day in people's ability to think. You know, I'm older. My mind does not work as fast as it used to. I can't process information as fast as I once could. And yet I watch people drive. I watch people behave, whether they're standing in a line to order something or trying to make a decision about when they're in a store shopping. And I'm telling you that people have been dumbed down to the point they don't know how to think anymore. They can't process information and make a reasonable conclusion in a reasonable amount of time. And it's absolutely horrifying and frightening. So that is, it's why, you know, a guy like Bernie Sanders, who's a communist, who's never done anything in his life, can get the vast, overwhelming majority of the highly educated young vote.
I love it. I think he's done something great.
It is flabbergasting.
It's amazing. You see his stuff on social media go by, and they'd be calling him Bernie. Oh, poor Bernie. He's getting railroaded. Oh, poor Bernie. I mean, it's hard for me to even fathom that anybody could say.
It's hard to fathom how stupid.
I know.
Wholly, completely irrational we have become. Okay, so those are three. You're on a roll.
Yeah, three, and there was one more which I've already hit on, but think about if you're, once again, I'm viewing it from just one isolated case. I'm trying to destroy America as I'm as you're a one world order guy. You've got to divide the people. You've got to divide the problem, right? So you can start developing black against white, Latinos against whites, or whomever group you want to divide. That works up to a point. However, the one thing that they had control of, that they discovered they had control of, were the Muslims who actually believe they're going to heaven to kill you. So why would you bring them in? I mean, what could make you quicker to have everybody turn to you and say, for God's sake, declare martial law and protect us? What is it? Pax Romanus.
I was with you on the first three. I have two that I'm going to propose in favor of your last one. Your first three are profound. Okay, your first three was they destroyed the family, they destroyed the value of work, and they indoctrinated rather than taught through political correctness and academia. Doesn't mean you're right or you're wrong and I'm right. I'm just going to give you something else to think about.
Okay.
The next thing that they did is that they destroyed the value of money. Rather than money, which had always been a symbol of something tangible that had value, it was either gold or silver coin, or more recently, a certificate that was backed and exchangeable by certain amount of gold or silver. And they came up with this idea of fiat money, which was money liberated from tangible value, where money would actually become a liability, and that money would now be based on debt, not on something of intrinsic value.
Right.
Now, that gave them the ability to concede as much money as they wish to, without anybody complaining about it. And then they created central banks to manipulate that money. And the combination of central banks and fiat money has essentially transferred the wealth of the world from those who have actually earned it and made it and worked for it to those who have become dependent on the politicians who have stolen it from one party to give it to another. And this combination of fiat money and central banks and progressive politics whereby money is confiscated, literally stolen at gunpoint, from people who have earned it, and then filtered through the slimy hands of politicians to make people dependent on them, has had a devastating effect on the character of those who are dependent, on the will to produce of those who were productive, the value system, and the very viability of nations. When I told you that we could go from where we are to absolute anarchy over a weekend, yeah. It is fiat money and deficits and entitlements that have pushed us into that position.
Yeah, well, it enables all that. Yeah, that's all right,
so
there.
And
we all know. Anytime they want to collapse it, they can just push the button and do it.
Oh, I mean, it's
over that day.
They want to do it. All it would take is people to be spooked and to have 1% of the people say, you know what I think I'm going to do is I want to get my money out of that bank. If 1%
I want
my money, the entire thing collapses.
They don't have the money there.
It collapses in 24 hours, less than 24 hours, and they have to shut down credit cards during that period of time. So they have to shut down credit cards, and they will. They have to shut banks, and they will. And the whole thing collapses, literally over a matter of hours. So I would put that...
perception's just becoming...
Well, I had that on my side note, so that was a 4A, but okay, go ahead.
Okay, so I'm going to give that as 4, and now I'm going to give you a 5.
Okay.
The establishment of standing armies, militaries, and the building of those militaries, and the deployment of those militaries, and then the patriotic justification of those militaries, and then the integration of those militaries with the judicial system and police, and then the integration of all of that with spy agencies, all sold to the people of, we are providing your freedoms, we are looking out for your safety, we are there to protect you. And yet, those very institutions are the very ones that are robbing people of their freedoms, mm-hmm. that are grotesquely immoral, grotesquely counterproductive, and ultimately give the people absolutely no ability to rebel without paying the ultimate price. And they give
the power
totally
now,
complete control.
So there's an actual...
People have lost their ability to rebel. It is now impossible to rebel because of the integration of these enormous militaries. And this time last week, I went through and I talked about spy organizations and how much is spent and ranked them 1 through 15 and militaries 1 through 15, who have them and what they spent. I did that for a reason. And the reason is I think it is the fifth finger of this iron claw that has control of the world is the power that the militaries wield in favor of the empowered and against the people.
Mm-hmm. Now, how does that differ from any time in other empires? I mean, it's totally history repeating itself.
You know, I went through a period of time. I was describing Rome, Imperial Rome, mm-hmm. as the most vicious, disgusting, despicable nation, empire, and human history. And my son at the time, who is a historian by passion,
mm-hmm.
he said, yeah, they were bad. So was Carthage. So was Sparta. So was Greece. So were the Egyptians. So were the Hittites. So were the Babylonians. So were the Assyrians. So were the Persians, so were the Byzantines, so were the Ottomans. Why don't you name an empire in human history?
Human history.
There was any difference.
Yeah.
So, okay. He said, now, if you want to make the point of that Imperial Rome was the worst of all, that would be a valid point. He said, I would support that. Imperial Rome was the most vicious of all human empires.
And you're
but they're no different than any other. Man has never been anything other than religious, political, militaristic, stunningly deadly and vicious.
Right.
Horrible.
Well, you know, that's what everything that Yahweh said would happen in the form of governments did. We know that really, basically, it's the criminal element that rises to the top in world leadership. It always has been. And if history teaches anything, might is right. Might is right. I mean, might is right. That's what it teaches, and there's no question about that. So,
that's
kind of where we were left. I just wanted to know if you had a different take. I mean, my take is that it's intentional to destroy the country, and the Kirk, obviously.
Yeah.
And
Kirk said something a week ago that caused me to rewrite the beginning of Chapter 9 of Observations. And I was talking about Hannah, and I don't want to go much into Hannah today. I wanted to return to Yashaya. I told you that I devoted this entire chapter, number 9, to Hannah. The most interesting thing I have ever done. I can't wait to get it further along where I can share it. It is my favorite. I thought that Chapter 8, which was Yahweh's relationship with Dode, was as good as it would ever get. Because, you know, I'm as close to idolizing Dode as you could be. Yeah, I mean,
you've been accused of pushing the religion of Dode, by the way.
Yeah, I have a man crush on Dode. There's just no question about it. I mean, when Yahweh says the things that he did about Dode, writing that chapter, serious fun for me. I didn't think anything would ever compare to that, and 9 has been, you know, 9, the purpose of 9 was to present the third chapter of Yashia. That's where I was, so I translate the first verse of the third chapter of Yashia, and that is the only verse of Yashia that I've translated, and I won't get to a second one in the entire chapter. And it was because of what God said, and he introduced it with Hinnah, and I said, you know, the first time that I wanted to deal with Hinnah was he used Hinnah with Noah. And I was going to, you know, just start there and say, this is how God introduces Hinnah. But that's not where he introduced Hinnah. And Kirk, a week ago, quoted where the first time that Hinnah comes up. And it comes up in the most obscure place. It is in the first chapter of Barashit of Genesis. He has just finished the fifth day of creation. And Yahweh is, saying, then I created mammals, and that was good. And then I decided to create this concept of microevolution, and that worked out really well. And then next I thought, why don't I create man? But with man, I'm going to do something different. I'm going to create man in my image. And then he repeats that like 3 different times. I want to create man in our image, in my image. And, and male and female, I'm going to create them. And our image, we're going to create them. And man in our likeness, over and over and over and over again. And he said, that was really good. And he said, I'm going to get down on my knees, and I'm going to lift up this man in love. And that's really good. We don't have a behold yet. And then Yahweh says, I'm going to talk to this man. And the first thing he says is, behold. Oh, my, wow. Pay attention. Stand up, look up. Pay attention to the details. Notice what I'm about to say. Behold. And what he said next, there's no reason to say it. He said, I created and gave you plants that yield seeds and trees that yield fruit and seeds. And you can eat them.
Yep.
Oh, boy.
Yeah, by the way, that was pretty profound when you said that.
Okay, thank you. I really appreciate that that insight on horticulture. I'm sure Adam and Chawa were all over that, too. And, you know, that way to go with your first behold. I'm really impressed, Scott. And I said, no. God would not have said that for that reason. He's introducing an extremely important concept here. When God speaks of food, he ain't talking about food. You know, here this the company was saying that not only about the these trees and these plants, but they had seeds. And this, you know, the whole process of this understanding of these seeds was really important. I said, he's not talking about seeds. And he ain't talking about plants. What God is saying is that if you are nourished by what he provides, then not only are you going to flourish and live and grow, but you're going to produce offspring, children, that flourish, live, and grow. And what he is in essence saying is that if you rely on me on what you consume and you are nourished by what I have provided, it's going to work out really good for you. I ain't talking about plants. I'm talking about my words.
Like decorum. Listen to what, talking about
to,
barley.
Right. If you listen to what I have to say, and if you consume it, if you are nourished by it, here's all the wonderful things that are going to happen to you. Oh, by the way, by implication, if you choose to consume things that aren't from me, you're going to get sick and die. That's what he was saying. And, you know, sometimes you've got to be smart enough to recognize that if God's going to stop the presses and throw out his first behold, you know, he's not going to follow it with dribble. What is he really saying here? Anyway, that's...
No, he repeats it over and over and over and over. So, I mean, it's not...
No, that's a strong...
Think about it now in the concept, yeah.
There was somebody that really got upset with the, you know, love your mother and father. I think this means biological mom and dad. And, of course, when you put it in context, you know, obviously it can't.
It's
sort of like claiming Daniel was practicing religious veneration. You know, I mean, you can't. When he turns the opposite of what he said he was doing.
What you're doing at that point is you're removing the statement from its context. Now, I went into this by saying this is what God was saying, and then he went through this point. If you can consider anything out of context and come to an errant conclusion. If you were just to read the second... Of the seven statements that God etched on the second of the two tablets, and you'd read it in an English Bible, and you could come to that conclusion. But if you read it in context, and you read it correctly translated, and you read what he said in the first, second, and third statement, it's impossible to come to that conclusion.
That's
absolutely
right.
Absolutely impossible. You see, this is the second statement. You don't conclude it by saying that fathers corrupt their children to the third and fourth generation.
Yes, so go honor them for it.
And two statements later say, oh, boy, what you need to do if you want to live a long time is honor your father. And think that
that would be the dim-witted approach, wouldn't it?
Yeah, I think that he's talking about your earthly dad. You know, my earthly dad... Come back. Physically and mentally abusive. You know, a racist. Anti-Semite. My earthly dad's a scumbag. I last spoke with him, let's say, 20 years ago or more. I don't know if he's alive or dead. I don't even care. For Yahweh to tell me I ought to view my dad as important, as significant, and honor him would be like saying that God is absolutely ignorant of my reality. And it would be totally contradictory based upon what he said in the second statement. So, you know, while I asked Yah today, he says, listen, if there's something that I'm advocating is wrong, you know, I really want to know what it is because, you know, I'm so convinced based upon the constant reinforcement and the consistency of everything you said that the lone voice calling out to people something that is profoundly true and profoundly important that nobody seems to want to hear. And that's the way it ought to be. But, you know, I really want to know. And I don't think there's one chance in a billion that those folks are right.
Can I just want to point out a translation here, okay?
Mm-hmm.
I want people that are listening to this to seriously consider the work that goes into a proper translation. And this is a real simple one. It's in Zechariah. In the day he is great, the shouts in Jerusalem will be like the wailing of Hadad Ramon in the valley of Mogidon, the basis for Armageddon. Now, Mogidon was a Canaanite city. It was associated with Jezreel, the whore of Babylon, in 1 Kings 4:12. It's
right.
Based upon
Jezreel means. You know what it means?
No, go ahead.
Babylon. It means married to the Lord.
Married to. Oh, yeah, I guess it would. That's lovely. A whore is enough for me. But that's getting there, ain't it? It's based upon Gadad, meaning to invade, penetrate, attack, to cut oneself off. There's an inference in the name suggesting a gathering of troops, large crowds, and a fortified position. Gadad also means to be cut down. Gadud is a marauding band of warriors out on a raid. Another related term is Megaboth, meaning turban headgear. Megid is choice, and thus infers this is the place and the time of final decisions. This is just one aspect of a breakdown in yada yada. Now, when somebody goes and they read a word in their Bible or religious material or whatever they're doing, and then they go to somebody who publishes that Bible, who then provides a word that works within the context of the way it's already written in the Bible, without this forethought, without this study, without going and doing background, what you're going to end up with is religious material. And the reason that when you look at Craig's or Kirk's or JB's actual translations, what you're going to find is real straightforward words that make sense and they fit together as a whole. I have yet to see Yahweh contradict himself in honest translations. Not anywhere. Not anywhere. But Bibles are full of it. And it's all religious sounding passages. I wanted to get that out there because I want people to understand the depth that goes into translating. I get messages all the time. Where should I go to get the right translation? Well, I got news for you. There is no such a place. It takes time. It takes effort. How long does it take you to do a passage, Yada?
Well, I'm going to give you an example because you were just mentioning it. Yesterday,
okay.
I spent all day yesterday, and I didn't finish one passage. The one passage I was on, I'd already started. I did not finish. And it's a really...
How many words
passage.
In that passage? How many words?
Okay, it is from... It's Barashit, Genesis, mm-hmm. obviously, 22:5.
Okay.
I'm presenting the seventh meeting between Yahweh and Abraham. And there was a line... It is by far at least in English Bibles, the least important line in the entire story. And, you know, it basically says, if you read an English Bible, so, you know, Abraham spoke to his servant, and he said, you should stay here with the donkey. And we are going to walk up over there, and then we're going to bow down and worship. And then after that, we'll return to you.
I'm reading that right now out of a New International Version. Yeah, that's what it says. Stay with the donkeys. I and the boy are going to go there. We'll worship, and then we'll be back. Yeah, right. Okay.
So why would it take me, by the time I was really finished with it and commented on it, I'd invested 2 full days. I had 20 hours in a single
10 hours a day.
10 hours. 20. I had 20 hours in one statement. That's why sometimes it just takes so long. And it was because right at the beginning, I had a hunch that there's no way that God's going to throw out trivial detail. And so there's something going on here that I need to figure out what it is. And then once I do, I need to walk anybody who's going to read this through the process of figuring it out. I need to share everything I know about every word and the history of every word and how I came to understand these words, because what I was going to come up with, I just said, what I was going to come up with was so different that it would be worth the time of then taking people through the entire process of what goes into rendering a translation like this. How do you come up with that meaning? And then, lastly, now that you have that meaning, what does it mean? What are the implications of it?
You want to tell us? I mean, this is going to be like a cliffhanger. Tell us what it says.
Okay. I'll begin.
And pull up, you guys, pull up 20, pull up, just for fun, pull up Genesis 22:5 on your computers, and then you can see what the assholes wrote, and they are assholes.
All right.
Go ahead.
I'll just have a preface. I'll go back. I don't know exactly where I started this, but let me just throw it out. Okay, there may be many reasons why we are told that Abraham, after elevating his perspective, was able to perceive and consider the miracle of life that would occur here from afar. By lifting our eyes to God, we become aware of what's going to occur and what effect it's going to have on us long before these events play out in our time. And in this case, it would be 40 Yobel from 1968 BCE to 33 CE before Yahweh would fulfill his promises in this place. So I'm still commenting on the previous verse there. And I said, I'm often embarrassed by the inadequate and sometimes erroneous nature of my initial attempts at translation. And yet, even though I've made more than my share of mistakes, a few copies of those, and very few copies of my original translations even survived. In retrospect, the end result was still considerably more thoughtful, consistent, accurate, and complete than those published elsewhere. Nonetheless, I've subsequently gone back over my previous translations, improving them, while updating the commentary derived from them many, many times, and have devoted years of my life not only to correcting my mistakes, but more importantly, to share what I've learned along the way. Now, I share this with you now for several reasons. First, in one book or another, with the notable exception of Yashaya 3:1, I've already translated every conversation found in this chapter. And I'm now at the 65th page of this chapter. There isn't a single verse in this entire chapter now that I hadn't already translated before. And yet I didn't even look at any of my original translations. And yet, while those attempts eventually led me to the single most important discovery of my life, which is the nature, requirements, and benefits of the Bereth family covenant, and to their fulfillment through the Mikra invitations to be called out and meet with God. My previous translations were so inadequate by comparison. Much of what has been conveyed thus far in this chapter, I suspected, but could not confirm until now. Second, if I'm able to substantially improve a translation each time it is rendered, and if I continue to gain insights during the process, even my most recent attempt is incomplete and imperfect. Therefore, I would encourage you to verify what you're reading and to augment what you can learn as a result. And third, this next statement is either superfluous or profound. Depending on whether Ode Co and Chawa are translated using their primary or secondary meanings. Additionally, when we contemplate what we are being told through the lens that has been corrected and accurately reflects each word's proper meaning, one of the most troubling New Testament misrepresentations is exposed. So here it is. So Abraham is an interesting word. And I did a whole study on Abraham early in this chapter. It can mean any one of four things depending on how you think the word is comprised. It's either father, who raises and lifts up those who stand up and reach up. In other words, adding a hey to room. Father of the abundantly enriched, which would be from just Ab and room without the consideration of the hay. Merciful Father, which would be Ab and Raham, or fathers of multitudes who are confused and troublesome, which is Ab and Hamon.
Well, I don't think it's the last one.
Don't be so sure. I think it's all of us. It's how you respond to this conversation between Abraham and Yahweh that determines which category you are. You know, Abraham is the father of Islam, the father of Judaism, the father of Christianity, according to those religions. They are all descendants of an offspring of Abraham, twisted, corrupted offspring. So you got to be careful. I think it's all of us. And you know, how you respond to these things will determine which category you fit into. So Abraham said to his young men, not servants, El Ebed, who is boys with him. Doesn't mean servant, it's young boys who are with him. He said to his young men, the boys who are with him.
So we're in a plural, not a singular.
There's two of them. Previously, they were numbered. There's two of them. And I had made a terrible mistake on the two of them and a long time ago, and I'm trying to correct it here. You should remain here with the donkey. Yishab, La, Aka, Ha, Em, Ha, Chamor. You should remain here with the donkey. And the boy and I, Wa'ani Na'ar, my child and I, we will walk halak. We will journey. Ad ko, this way toward eternity. We will walk forever like this, in this manner, continually, throughout the entirety of space, and thusly for an unlimited period of time. We will walk this way without any constraints on distance or direction traveled. We will walk this way to convey and to reveal an important transition and to encourage everyone to focus their undivided attention on what is about to occur, especially as it pertains to eternity. Now, that is not the way you see Ad Ko rendered in any English language. And then what comes next is Wah Chawa. And independently, we will announce our intentions regarding the continual restoration and preservation of life, consistently making our conclusions known on our own initiative, Wachawa, by explaining our personal position on renewal, by verbally declaring our commitment to continually grow of our own accord and acting independently, providing our verbal pledge demonstrating our attitude and perspective on Eternal Life, written in the Hittite stem, where the subjects of the verb, Abraham and Isha, are acting with respect to themselves, by themselves, and on their own initiative. With the imperfect conjugation, it reveals their ongoing commitment to continually making this declaration on eternal life, realizing that it will have ongoing and unfolding results throughout time. Washub. Then we will choose of our own volition to return, to change, and to restore you. Washub El Asa. Then our desire will be to bring this back to you for your restoration, transforming you into a more favorable state by repairing the relationship, by continuing to actually gather together in this way. Call imperfect cohortedness, genuinely and actually, on a consistent basis with ongoing implications, desiring and choosing to return, to turn to change, and to restore you forever.
That's huge.
Mundane became profound.
Yeah.
Now,
yeah, that's huge.
Share some of the insights I have here, and interrupt anytime you want to. By defining the phrase in this sentence, or the defining, I should say, phrase in this sentence, is predicated on ad co, which you will find inadequately and possibly errantly translated over there in Bibles published by religious institutions.
That's what it says, over there. That's exactly what it says, over there.
That is perplexing because there is no question whatsoever about the primary connotation of the Hebrew adverb ad. It means into eternity or perpetuity, forever and continuously. And it addresses eternal existence, infinity in either space or time, being unlimited or being without constraint. Ad is derived from its verbal root, adam, which is to advance and to pass on, to pass through by removal of constraints or by taking away any hindrance, often as a result of a unique garment or special form of adornment. Also revealing, Ad is derived identically to Ed.
I do want to jump in. That special, that would be like being covered in the Ruach, as an example.
Of course.
Mm-hmm.
Uh-huh. Well, you're thinking here. You're thinking.
Yeah, this is also all right in line with everything I understand. It's making sense.
Also revealing, Ad is scribed identically in Hebrew to Ed, which means eternal witness and everlasting testimony. Both are related to Ud and are likely based on it, which is relevant because Ud speaks of continually testifying about restoration and repeatedly bearing witness to eternal healing. Odd secondary connotations, until, up to, as far as, or continuously, are simply derivatives of its primary meaning. Ko is a compound of ka, which is typically translated like, similar to, consistent with, akin to, analogous, or comparable. And who, the pronoun, conveys he or she, depending on how it's written, or it, in English. The combination is, therefore, often rendered thus, in this manner, in this way, like this, or so far as. While such translations are not supported by Ko's etymology, there are those who have constrained its meaning to here, there, or now. Now, having studied the etymology of Ad and Ko, the translation I have provided is an informed and thoughtful attempt to incorporate these factors.
You know, the actual words really mean.
I took hours. So while I've made
words mean things.
Yeah,
okay.
So while I've made mistakes in the past, and while I'm a student, not a scholar, and recognizing that this may be inadequate, the rendering of Ad Ko as this way toward eternity, forever like this, in this manner continuously, throughout the entirety of space, and thusly for an unlimited period of time without any constraints on distance or direction traveled, which is being conveyed to reveal an important transition and to encourage us to focus our undivided attention upon what is about to occur, especially as it pertains to infinity, is reasonably accurate and complete. In the first person plural, the primary definition of chawa, which should be more accurately transliterated chawa, is announce our intentions, making them known, by explaining our position, verbally declaring our commitment, informing using spoken words. Chawa or chawa is to show, to interpret, to explain, to inform, to tell, and to declare. That's not how it was translated, however.
And they put worship. They put worship.
That is right. But according to God, and as is recorded in Bereshit 3:20, there is more to it than that. Chawa is written using the same three characters found in Chawa, the name of Adam's wife, one which we are told was based upon the verb chaya, which means to live. Now, I use this connection to clarify the nature of the declaration Abraham and Yitzhak had intended to announce, but more on that in a moment. For reasons that are hard to explain, chawa is presented as if it means to worship in the vast preponderance of Bibles published by religious institutions. I suspect that this is a product of the Latin Vulgate, in which Jerome translated the Greek Septuagint into Latin and ignored the Hebrew text. The first five English Bibles of the 15th and 16th centuries, including or leading to the King James Version in the 17th century, were initially translated from the Latin Vulgate, and then revised one from the next, all trying to keep the familiar phrasing of its predecessor. Therefore, an errant translation in the Greek Septuagint or the Latin Vulgate would never have been correct to reflect the original and underlying Hebrew text. Moreover, virtually every lexicon available for our consideration was compiled by one of the principal Bible publishers, and each, therefore, was prone to justify their own translations, regardless of their accuracy. Somewhere along the way, a religious scribe or a theologian either made a mistake or deliberately altered the text and changed the witness Yahweh provided through Moshe. There is no justification whatsoever for translating chawa as worship. Now, to their credit, Strong's, which was originally conceived to support the translations found in the King James Version, didn't play along. They do not render any variation of chawa as worship. To their shame, Strong's transliterates chawa, written C-H-W-H, in the text as chawa, under their number 2331. This pronunciation is impossible, as the publisher is aware, because there is no V in Hebrew. Further, Strong reveals that it should be compared to 23:24 and to 24:21. But 23:24, while inexplicitly transliterated chava with an apostrophe at the end of it as opposed to the hey, as if the letter ain was there rather than the hey, was written correctly in Hebrew and yet incorrectly in their transliteration. They made it look like that 23:24 was actually a different word when it's exactly the same word. Why would they do that?
Isn't that something? See, this is the kind of thought we're talking about. And keep going. I just want people to understand there's so much that goes into really getting this
as close to right as we can. I think that the only thing more important than getting it right is helping people understand the process that went into it, because that's empowering. So, this error aside, their primary translation of 2331 is accurate. They have chava, verb, one, to tell, to declare, show, and make known. Two, to breathe. The same is true of Strong's 2324, Chaba, verb, corresponding to 2331, to show, to interpret, to explain, to inform, to tell, to declare. Strong's got it right. The transliteration was right, but their definition was right on the money. They don't even have a variation that means to worship. My favorite lexicon, Dictionary of Biblical Languages, Hebrew. I think that James, I think it's your favorite too.
The one with Hebrew domains?
It's called the DBL. It's my favorite. Was initially correct. 2551 verb. Hawa. Tell, explain, announce, verbally show, display with words, i.e. inform and announce with speech. But alas, as if presenting an entirely different word, they compromise scholarship for readership with 2556, 2, hawa, verb, 1, bow down, prostrate oneself, i.e. take a stance of bowing low in an aspect of respect or honor, but necessary.
Now, who put this in? Who put that in there?
Bowing worship, prostrating oneself. The Dictionary of Biblical Languages.
The one that's normally correct. They went into
the
rabbis.
Yeah, I would say any was normally correct, but it's my favorite, just because of the way they go about presenting words.
The format is
And they were right. 2-5-5. Kawa means to tell, explain, announce, verbally show, display with words. Then they have a second variation of it. They said, 2-5-5-6 is really a second variation of 2-5-5-5. And that time when the word appears, although it's written identically, it's now a verb that means to bow down, to prostrate oneself.
Right, sure.
How are those ideas even remotely related?
Digging a little deeper, and based on the fact that Chawa and Choa is indistinguishable from Chawa or Choa, depending on your favorite vocalization, and a recognition of the fact that Yao affirms that the name of Adam's wife is based upon Chaya, there's ever reason to support the connection to Strong's 2421, which is Chaya, to live and remain alive, to be restored to life, to be revived, to vigorous growth, flourishing in abundance, life sustained, preserved, and enduring. This association would not only explain the extraordinarily uncommon pronunciation associated with Chawa, as opposed to the more prevalent transliteration of the Hebrew wa, but also mean that Chawa's name is more than just life giver. It proclaims her position on life, announcing and declaring the need for renewal and restoration. Further, since Yahweh himself is a witness to the connection between Chawa, to announce one's intentions, and Chaya, to live, renewing, restoring, and sustaining life, a complete and accurate rending of Chawa should indicate that Chawa is a declaration about Chaya, about the restoration and preservation of life. Now, guys, what we're going to do, we're 10 seconds left. I'm just going to continue on here for a while, and it's going to continue to record, and those who are interested in this can listen to it later. It's going to be part of the archives. But is that okay with you guys? We just continue on, even though we're no longer broadcasting?
Please do. No, I'm still listening.
You brought up what goes into a translation, and this is one that I did over the last 2 days. I just thought it would be an interesting thing to share. All right.
It's totally interesting because it hits home. See, there's a group that goes on, basically attacking us all the time. This is a group that claims the word God replaced Yahweh. Well, in fact, it was Baal, Lord, God replaced Elohim. And by the way, they always say the Mighty One. Well, if they're going to do it, it should be the Mighty Ones, because
right.
Elohim is plural of El. So they can't even get what replaced what right in a very basic manner. And they knock your translations because they just don't have the tenacity nor the ability, probably even the tools, mentally they certainly don't, to go in and dig and say, wait a minute, this can't be right. Look, it's the same word, and you can't change the word.
Yeah,
but go ahead,
I just want to make this really clear.
Yeah.
There is no acumen that I possess that uniquely qualifies me somehow to do this and precludes others.
You don't you have
there, there's only two requirements in pursuing and delivering a reasonably accurate and complete translation. The first is the most important. The first is the most important. You have to know Yahweh.
Yeah,
if you don't know Yahweh, then I think it is impossible. That
if you're obeying commands and worshiping and promoting religious veneration and prayer service and all this nonsense, I don't want to hear what you have to say because you're hopeless.
You've got to know the nature of the person who is the author of these words. That is the single most important thing. And the second is, you have to be willing to invest the time. Those are the only two things. The rest of it is a lay down hand. If you go at it from knowing who Yahweh is and you're willing to invest the time, absolutely anyone can do this. Now, I think that I got lucky and there's a couple of characteristics, a couple of aptitudes that I have that help me a little bit here along the way. But they aren't necessary. I've slowed down, and there's a lot of people that can process information faster than I do. I do process information faster than most people. So even though this took 2 days, it might have taken somebody else 4 days because I've got a decent processor. The second is that I don't know why I was spockish in my nature, but I was really deprived of emotion. And my whole life has just been a pursuit of being as resolutely rational as I could be. I wouldn't wish that on anybody. For this process, it actually helps. And then there's only one skill set that I've ever thought that.
We have caught that, by the way.
Yeah,
we have caught.
It's who I am. I'm not apologizing for it. I'm just telling you, it helps this situation. I'm sure my wife wishes it was different. Now, there's one other thing that has always been just something that I enjoy doing, that I was always good at doing, that I don't understand why other people don't like to do, but make connections. So, if Yahweh makes the connection between Chawa and Chawa, the name and the verb, I want to make the same connection.
It's sort of like looking at Sheba and Shaba, isn't it? Since they're written identically.
Yeah, so
it's like that.
It's important to if you want to understand, you've got to assimilate the information and make the proper connections, and that leads to understanding. So I like those things. But beyond that,
I doubt if Yahweh made a mistake. When he wrote Shaba or Sheba, because he wanted you to look at both words. So seven is the promise. I get that. One's seven and one's an oath. So seven is the promise.
The basis of the Hebrew word for seven, for Shabbat, and for promise and oath is identical.
Yeah.
S-H-E-A. Those are the three letters. It's always the same. They mean all. They convey the basis of all three words, and therefore, if you make the connection between them, then what you have the Shabbat is telling us is that it's the promise of seven. What Shabu is telling us is the promise of seven, or the promise or the oath of the Shabbat. It's just about making connections. Okay, so now that we know what the word means and we're aware of the religious corruptions, there are two additional considerations. The hitpale stem and the imperfect conjugation. With these in mind, I would propose the following fully amplified rendering of Chawa when scribed in the first person plural. Independently announce our intentions regarding the continual restoration and preservation of life. Consistently making them known on our own initiative, explaining our personal position on renewal, verbally declaring our commitment to continually grow, and of our own accord and acting independently, providing our verbal pledge, demonstrating our attitude and perspective on eternal life, cognizant of the influence of the hitpale stem, whereby the subject of the verb, Abraham and Yishak, are acting with respect to themselves, by themselves, and of their own initiative, while also reflecting the implications of the imperfect conjugation, which reveals their ongoing commitment to continually making this declaration on eternal life, realizing that it will have ongoing and unfolding results throughout time. Now, you say, okay, that's one word, and you wrote a paragraph on it, yes?
Yeah.
So you tell me, what part of that did God not intend to communicate?
No, that's observations, pal. That's what the book's called, so that's what it is.
Can I say something here for a second?
Sure, huh?
Well, when it comes to, like, these groups that Larry was talking about and stuff, it always seems like, you know, you can always tell when someone's religious or they still got a little bit of that with them. You got these people, they find out a few things. The first thing they want to do is build themselves a little church of their own or whatever, and then start telling everybody that they're wrong. You know, that's different from this group, really. Everybody's learning on their own, and it's more of a journey. It's not like the information or the knowledge is static. So there's never a point where we're, you know, trying to, you know, spending all our time disagreeing with somebody else so much, you know.
I just spend a good, decent amount of time making fun of them. I will tell you.
We don't have a whole lot of time here, so I want to press on through this because this was a point you brought up, and I wanted just to explain.
No, I want to hear
what the process is. This is just one verse. Okay.
Yes.
Getting this right should have been easy.
You know.
Yeah, so getting this right should have been easy. God had said nothing to Abraham about bowing down or worshiping him, and in fact, had asked him to do the opposite. So correctly prostrating himself could not have been part of any test. This is not Islam. Based upon what Yahweh had conveyed, what he had offered and requested, the only valid way to test Abraham would be to assess his knowledge, understanding, acceptance, and subsequent response to the terms and conditions of the covenant as they had been presented by Yahweh. Chawa could be Abraham's reply, his declaration of understanding, his announcement affirming his acceptance of God's offer. Well, that is a lot of information. Before we return to the overall translation of Bereshit 22:5, I would also like to call your attention to Chawak, written very similar, just with a hard H at the end. It means thorn or thorn bush, because it will eventually reappear in this conversation in association with the means to life.
Mm-hmm.
Now, the concluding verb in this passage is shuv. It means to return, to come back, to turn around, to change, to be restored as a result of changing direction. It is the fifth most common verb appearing in the Torah, Nambi, and Mizmor just over 1,050 times. And while there is no debate regarding the fact that every connotation that I've just shared applies, most translators truncate its meaning by limiting their renderings to one of these concepts when they're all related and they all apply. With this in mind, we ought not lose fact of the fact that shuv was scribed in the first person plural, call stem, imperfect conjugation, and the cohortative mood. Therefore, at the very least, following Abraham's announcement on his intentions regarding restoration and the preservation of life, in the third person plural, call imperfect cohortative, shuv should have been translated, then we will choose of our own volition to return to change, and to restore you. This presentation of Wah Shub El Ata could then be expanded to convey additionally, our desire will be to bring this back to you for your own restoration, transforming you into a more favorable state by repairing the relationship through our continuing to actually gather together in this way. The call stem, imperfect conjugation, and cohortative mood convey genuinely and actually on a consistent basis with ongoing implications, desiring and choosing to return, to turn to change, and to restore you forever. Unless these ideas are brought together and seen as related, as a progression from one to the next, the purpose of sharing Chawa and Shub is squandered. Now for an interesting thought. We are told in Luke 23:32, quote, "And two others also were criminals," or two others also who were criminals, "were being led away and put to death with him." I'm going to read that again because it's really important how it's phrased. "And two others also who were criminals were being led away to be put to death with him." Now, some have thought, including me some time ago, that you could draw a comparison between the two others and the two young men in Abraham's story. But this is wrong to do so for many reasons. First, Luke's statement was written as if all three were criminals. "And two others also who were criminals?" Luke's statement was written as if all three were criminals, as if all three were being led to their death. Yosha had not committed any crime, and God cannot die. By way of contrast, three individuals accompanied Abraham, making four in total. Not one of them was a criminal, and they were all being led to life, not death. Beyond this, if Yishak represents the son, and thus Yosha's body on Passover, if Abraham as the father represents Yahweh's soul on yeasted bread, and if the two witnesses who were estranged from the other two initially, but were then reunited, represent the set-apart spirit on firstborn children and the promise of seven, then the cast has been assembled, and the order of their participation in the first four mikre has been revealed. Additionally, the hearsay statement in Luke 23:44, "Who was not an eyewitness to this event or any aspect of Yosha's life. Truly, I say to you today, you will be with me in paradise." As a result of what we have just learned, it can be discarded.
That's nonsense.
This was not said. This was not said and did not occur. There would have been no basis for the criminal's salvation. Paradise is a pagan concept, and Yosha wasn't going anywhere on Passover. Even on the following day, on the Shabbat of Matzah, his soul was destined for Sheol, which is a far cry from paradise.
I just want to throw something in here. And then that matches what you're saying, matches 100% with, I think it's the end of Chabawook, or maybe it's in the Mishal. I think it's at the end of Chabawook where he talks about, and then they're standing in front of this piece of wood which obscures further observations, which would be Matzah and Purim.
Yeah, that's correct.
And
right.
So that's where they stop, right there. The paradise, you're going to be with me today. Well, we know full well that the day being fulfilled, the next day was Matzah, and Yosha's soul was there.
Right. The bottom line is that what happened here during their seventh meeting is a presentation of Pesach, Matzah, Bekorim, and Shavuah. And therefore, it's important to correct Luke's stupidity here, his error. Okay, now, one of the many reasons, therefore, that the story in Bereshit 22:5 is important is it reveals that no one would die or go to heaven on this day. Abraham and Yishak climbed Moriah, met with Yahweh, made their announcement, listened to God's plan to fulfill Pesach, passed the test, and returned to the young men who had stayed below as instructed, sharing with them what they had learned. It would be another 60 years before Abraham would enter heaven at the ripe old age of 175. He would father five additional children. Yishak would outlive his father and enter heaven 105 years thereafter. According to Yahweh, the Torah says, so Abraham said to his young men, you should remain here with the donkey, and the boy and I, we will walk this way toward eternity, and independently announce our intentions regarding the continual restoration and preservation of life. Then we will choose of our own volition to return to change, and to restore you. Abraham not only knew that he was being evaluated, he knew the subject of the test and was ready to deliver a correct answer. More than this, he not only knew that he would be returning with his son, he recognized that by sharing what would transpire on Moriah, mankind would return to God, be forever changed, and be restored. So why do you suppose the King James Version published, and Abraham said to his young men, abide ye here with the ass, and I and the lad will go yonder and worship and come back to you?
Christianity.
The New International Version is actually less accurate. He said to his servants, stay here with the donkey while I and the boy go over there. We will worship and then we will come back to you. As for corrupting their intent, as I suspected, the King James got it from the Vulgate, where the Latin adoravimus, A-D-O-R-A-V-E-R-I-M-U-S, I'm not a Latin scholar, that's obvious, was used to errantly infer that they were going to worship. That's what the Latin word means. If nothing else, I hope this exercise in translation provides some useful insights into the process. There are right answers and wrong ones, and some are better or worse than others. Since God never asked Abraham to worship him, this could not have been his expectation or the proper way to translate Chawa. Further, by accepting a minimalist view of either Ad Ko or Shuv, a profoundly important declaration is rendered irrelevant. This is the most important story ever told. Everything God says prior to the presentation of this covenant explains his basis for offering it, while everything he says thereafter either affirms its fulfillment or depicts the consequences of passing or failing this test. We have every incentive to get this right.
Hear, hear.
So, Larry, you said that, you know, there's a lot that goes into a translation.
Yes, I did. Yes, and I'm aware of it.
Yes, yes.
I do not have that time, and I don't have the tools.
No, I mean, I'll be honest. That took me 2 days.
It was
worthwhile. I enjoyed the 2 days.
That was 2 days, and how many years have you done translations? I mean, just lay it out there. 12 years.
Between 10 and 15, probably 12 years, yeah.
Yeah. So what, you know.
I'm impressed.
I'm a learner, like I said, I'm not a scholar, I'm a student.
The reason I lay that out there.
That's why I said to you earlier, I said, listen, I don't very often have long chats with Yahweh. I have long listens. What this was an exercise in a long listen.
Yeah, you get people though. They want to go out. They want to buy some book that they can just go and they can just get
it
translated.
It
just does not work like that. You have to fight with 5 different interlinears or dictionaries.
And
you have to find out who's trying to trick you and who's presenting the real information. And this time. You know, Strong's gave you the right information, and half the time it
wasn't. I reported on Strong's just because I wanted to throw him a bone. Because I thought it was interesting that Strong's didn't actually present the corrupt version, which is, don't explain it ever, that Strong's hasn't done that. You know, it's actually, I have come up with a different way to translate now.
Yeah.
I use the same tools, but I use them in a very different way. Now, I will look up a word like Jawa here, or there's two in this chapter that I've made an entire book about. Asher, which is my single most important word in my life. There's no word anywhere close to Asher. I end up writing darn near a book on Asher. I thought I really got Asher, because I used to translate Asher as to beneficially lead to the relationship, or for the benefit of the relationship is how I would render Asher.
Yeah.
Oh, well, that's 1% of Asher. That's 1% of Asher. Oh, and what I did is the same thing as with henna. And the same thing with chawa and all of these words. I've gone to an entirely different approach. And I'm going to share what that approach with you is. I'm not sure. Maybe, a year from now I'll have a different approach. What I do now is I have a tool with Logos that will link me in any lexicon to the word. And I'll quickly glance at the definition that's provided by that word. And then I will scroll up and I will scroll down and I will consider the meaning of every word that is written similarly. And I won't stop until I have exhausted my search of every word that contains similar letters. And I won't even stop then until I have found one of the words that serves as the verbal root of the word. And then I compile everything that I've learned from all of that, and then I use that now in the definition. So it's like I'm learning.
I can tell you're doing that.
I think I said last week that I've changed my mindset. I stumbled into something a couple of weeks ago that said, don't just write down your definition of this word. I know you've seen the word 1,000 times, and you just read the word, and you're not even going to look it up, and you're just going to give your definition. Do us both a favor and look it up again. And I was blown away by what I learned and how much I had missed. And I even forgot what the word is now. And so
that was actually, believe it or not, one of the attacks that they leveled on you is that what was the word she used? Expounds or whatever. You kind of have to. You really do. I mean, if you want to get some, if you want to, you could read this passage out of an English Bible, which was basically pointless, except that they were promoting the idea of worship. That was their only point to the whole thing, which, of course, is a lie. You know it when you read it.
Yeah. Well, of course, I knew the whole thing was presented in the context of Yahweh was going to evaluate, to test Abraham, and you can't test somebody on something you haven't instructed them. And there's been no instruction on worship, no instruction on bowing down. And so there has been nothing said about bowing down. You can't test him on that. So that was my first clue.
Yeah.
Now, I'm going to tell you that if someone were to accuse me of expounding too much on words, I would say, you're right. I'm guilty of that. I originally started being guilty of it because I didn't think I was smart enough when there were, say, 10 different words that could be used in that context to convey the meaning of the Hebrew word. I didn't think I was smart enough to determine which one of those God intended. If they could all apply, I thought that the safest bet, considering our relative intelligence, was to convey all of them. Because I just didn't think I wasn't smart enough to say, that no, he meant this one, but not that one. And so that's how I started that way. And it's not why I do it now. Well, surely I'm not smart enough to know which of those concepts of Jawa he intended. I suspect all of them. But that's not why I do it now. What maybe it's a combination of what I came to and what I've learned from our discussions with Roy. I've come to see now virtually every aspect of the covenant relationship with Yahweh about being expanded, about being multiplied, of having our dimensionality increased. That everything that God says is designed to empower us, to enrich us, to increase our capabilities And so when I look at his words, I look at his words as the tools that he uses to do that on our behalf. So since his goal is to empower us from being mortal beings that are flawed and susceptible to all sorts of limitations, to being unlimited in seven dimensions, I look at his words now as being the implements of achieving that promise. And if you look at words as being the literal building blocks of our empowerment, then you recognize how important it is to be expansive in their definition. That's why I do it now.
What you're trying to do is come to understand the word as the people who read it originally would have understood it, which would be how God intended it.
Words
in English, we understand them inherently because that's our native language, but when you're looking at another language, the word carried, you can't do a one-to-one translation.
That's partially true, and can I tell you why I think it's partially true, at least for me? Is that you and I always want to begin with what did the word mean when it was originally used? And that's important to convey because it's true. I never stop there anymore because I don't think that was Yahweh's intent. I think that the word was conveyed so that it would resonate and mean something to the first hearers of it. But all along the way, the potential that you could deduce from the word would continue to grow. An example is that that most of what we read in the creation account could have been understood at a very simplistic level by anyone who read it for the first 5,550 years of the human experience.
Yeah, now that's worked inversely. Now we understand a lot more.
Based upon what we know, our understanding of those words is hugely increased and amplified. We have a different perspective now that we can bring to those words that we can use to expand what they are conveying that would have had no value to people 1,000 years ago or 5,000
years ago. Like relativity, as an example.
Right, like relativity is exactly correct. And so that part of it, like when God said, I created the universe in the 6 days, and he walks you through the whole thing, and the people said, prior to the last 50 years, that was fine. But in the last 50 years, we were given a tool from Einstein, a formula from Einstein, and then a tool through the probes that have measured the microwave background radiation from the Big Bang. And now, based upon relativity and the formula that Einstein has given us, and the background from the Big Bang, we can actually do the math and show that 14 to 15 billion years divided by the stretching of time on cosmic microwave background radiation from the Big Bang reveals exactly 6 24-hour days from the point of view of the creator at creation, which is absolutely the same as 15 billion years with us looking back in time. And so we have tools that they didn't have then. And therefore, it's not just what the words meant to them at that time. It's what the words convey through the perspective that we're able to apply to them now. I'm going to tell you something, JB. One of the things that has struck me recently, and I've said this a lot of times, and it just never, I don't think I'm able to say it in a way that that resonates with people. So many folks say, their view, their perspective, their experience with God would be so much different if they were there with the Israelites in the wilderness. They watched the Egyptians be drowned in the Red Sea. If they saw the blazing top of the mountain, if they heard God actually speak from the top of the mountain, And I said, no. Our perspective on God, the tools that we have, that we can deploy, and understanding who he is, what he said, verify his veracity, his authorship, and then expound to understand this, is vastly superior than what they have had or what anyone has had prior to our time. We are sitting at the absolute perfect time to capitalize on his testimony. And that's profound, I think. We have been given an opportunity and a gift that goes beyond any people at any time in human history.
I've said to people before, what we're sharing here hasn't been shared in thousands of years. I mean, that's
right.
Just a fact.
Right.
And,
I don't think
everybody
says the time of Dode, other than obviously, if you were really clued in and you listened to Yasayah, if this was shared then. But boy, I don't think there's one in 1,000 people that understood what Yasayah was saying. It's been a long time.
That actually worked to our benefit, though, with the DSS, so they couldn't, copy
it.
So it worked to our benefit. I thought of that, too. One thing I want to point out here, and this was something that Lisa had brought up to me, and I asked her to remind me of this. You know, when you start looking at bread that's not leavened, what you're doing is you're taking flour, you're mixing it with water, and then when it's left out, in the actual environment itself, the one we live in, all the particles floating around in the air infiltrate the mix and make the fine grain ferment, and what happens to become sour, she was talking about how to do sourdough, is all the bacteria acts like an agent, and it comes, the yeast feeds off of it. That's where you get the growth of the yeast, and that's where you get the puffiness and everything else. And it's like our very environment. You talk about matzah bread. I mean, there's an actual science here. You understand?
Yeah.
I mean, this goes right to what we're talking about. There's all these nuggets in there, and there's thousands of them. Just thousands and thousands and thousands of them.
Yeast. Is made to, was used to brew beer and wine. And the fact that beer and wine, because the yeast causes the fermentation of the grain or the grape, it turns it into alcohol. And alcohol will impair judgment. If you get too much alcohol, your judgment is impaired. And so this connotation of yeast and the application of yeast and what it does to one's judgment and the thing that was most common to them, I think is something they would have gotten that we stumble on now because we just don't think of that connection. And of course, he uses it in bread. And in bread, what's really interesting about yeast, you know what yeast really is? It's fungus.
It's ferment.
It's a fungus. It's a fungus.
Sure it is.
It's just the kinds of things that we can apply to the testimony, are so profound. When God was speaking about the ants, you can learn a lot from the ant. When he was speaking about the ant, I don't think that even 1% of what he said would have resonated with the first to hear what Dode had written about the ants.
No, it couldn't have. No.
Right. But
I mean, how would they know that?
There's two things that we know now about the ants that cause that to be profoundly insightful for us. One is we know that essentially all ants are female.
And two, they act independent.
And the males don't do squat. And so, first of all, you read that and you say, wow, incredible. This was written, 3,000 years ago. This is really credible. Pay attention. And the second is, we didn't know until really very recently that ants have no hierarchy. There's no foreman, there's no lords, there's no ministers, there's no bureaucrats, there's no government, there is nothing. And Yao is constantly making the point, the thing you ought to learn from the ant is they're not just industrious, they got no overlords. They've got absolutely no one telling them what to do. No government, no religion. No clerics, no priests, no politicians, no government officials, no kings, no nothing. We didn't know that about ants until, what, last 25 years?
Yeah. This century, certainly. This past century.
Yeah, I was watching a Discovery show or something here last week where they were talking about the ant sheep.
Yeah.
I know that. I know that.
Just those two points ought to, by themselves, when exposed to somebody, if you're being open-minded and you're willing to go where the words lead, you ought to say, the odds of getting that right without having actually created them and understanding what you had created is essentially zip. To pick the one animal that is only women, and to say, hey, the thing unique here is that they have no government. No, they have.
It's profound.
Every other animal.
I said it when we were doing it. It's profound.
You look at any other animal, and they have a hierarchy. Not ants. I mean, you just have to say, okay, that's profound. That proves something that we ought to pay attention to.
Right, but people don't, people aren't, I brought this up to several people, by the way. And do you know their eyes roll?
Yeah, I know. Amazing.
It's astonishing to me. It's just like, here's a truth that I can present to you. This could get you eternal freedom. Freedom.
Right, right.
And it essentially means nothing. If it doesn't have to
be
business,
I'm not going to believe God until he proves his existence. And I said, what if I demonstrate to you that he proved his existence? Then what?
It's lip service. I know what it is. It's because it's the same reason that, they try to make it sound like, I was doing some kind of social commentary on widows and orphans.
Yeah.
Right. When what he's saying is people that have no father, no mother, that's the Ruach in me. And you should really especially take time with the people looking. And that's what I've come to understand. You can't, there's no point in giving this information out to a lot of people. It's for the people that are looking. And the people that are actually found because we feed each other, so.
Of course. Well, like, for example, that whole 2 days to translate and try to understand one statement that is so mundane and inconsistent in English Bibles. I spent 2 days of my life on it. And you know something? I was enriched to the point of goosebumps. That's how much it meant to me. And now I had the opportunity to share it. And that was even more enriching. Yeah, it was even more enriching. And so, if they want to mock, let them do it. If they want to criticize.
Oh, I mocked them back. Believe me, they don't even.
I'm going to tell you that this decision to return to just do this, I am so, so happy with it, so content with it. This is fun.
Right. By the way,
can I pass something for Larry?
Sure.
Larry, when the guy asked you about, he's talking about his biological father. Ask him why when he asked Abraham to leave Babylon, he told him to leave his dad there.
There's a good point.
I think I'll add that to the note I've got on it.
That's
a very good point. Very good point.
Yeah.
Yeah, there's a way to honor your biological father. Walk away from him.
Yeah,
this is called thinking, Kirk, and this is something outside the realm.
How dare you connect the dots?
Yeah, well, that's a good point. I found the other day, and I sent this to Craig in an email.
Right.
I had somebody that kept saying, bizarre. You know what they do is they look up bizarre in a word search, and it says 98 times, and then they give you all the little passages where it means flesh. And I said, it's really interesting because the word bizarre was used when the police day had killed Sheol, King Sheol. and they ran around his head spreading the good news. They used the word bizarre. And it's funny when Yah was telling us not to read Christian material, you know, that it also uses the word bizarre there, too. And then that's Sheol's lies. So you got Sheol's death and Sheol's lies. And bizarre is used in both of them.
Yeah. There are some words, there are a lot of words in Hebrew that have opposite meaning, depending on the context they're used. You know, the most famous is Yara. It means
Yara.
Respect, or respect or to
fear.
Fear. Mm-hmm. Yeah, and so you to render an accurate translation, you have to know how the word is being used in that context and what it's being applied to. Because sometimes it is appropriate to render it fear, and sometimes it's appropriate to render it revere and respect. The Shah is a really a famous one because its primary meaning, overwhelmingly, and about 99% of the time that it's used, it means to answer and respond. But it also can mean afflict. And so if it's being used in conjunction with an invitation, it obviously means that the primary meaning ought to be used because with an invitation, the appropriate thing to do is to answer and respond. But, you know, if you don't answer and respond to the invitation, your soul will be afflicted. So the secondary meaning comes into play. So there are a lot of words like that that are specifically designed to show cause and consequence. It's like Abraham. I gave you four definitions of Abraham. And you said, I know what
you're saying. And you're right. There could be consequences to all of them.
I say, I think they all apply. It's just like in Anah. I think afflict also applies, depending on whether or not you answer the invitation. You know, so it's the nature of the language, and by doing that too, what it removes is the thoughtless approach. You know, I think that I shared this with somebody today, and what I told them is that there are no easy answers to coming to know God, and it was designed that way. And the reason that it's designed that way is eternity is a really long time. And eternity, the only thing that we're going to be doing in eternity is exploring and sharing. You know, we're going to have a universe. We're going to go out and explore that universe. We're going to interact with that universe. We're going to experiment with that universe. We're going to have great fun out there. And then we're going to come back and share what we did with others. Kind of like, you know, reading the word, learning something, and then can't wait to come back and tell the others, hey, look what I found. That's what we're going to do in all eternity. Can you imagine how awful that would be if a significant number of the people in eternity just wanted to sit around all day and just weren't interested in going out and exploring or sharing? And eternity is a really long time to put up with somebody that's just a bum.
And let's go play.
And so
play.
I think God just said, you know, that's going to be the litmus test. This is what we're going to be doing in eternity. If you're not willing to do that here and now, I'm just going to keep you out because you'll ruin it for the rest of us. I think it
was. I thought I understood bizarre can mean flesh, and it generally does. But what I'm saying is when the person lays that out, it's thoughtless because I even told him, I said, in this context, it does not make any sense. Especially when you go down further and he talks about the dead, just their stupid, contemptuous, decaying dead bodies. It's obvious to me that any animal that dies, then you could say that about. And we're talking about a specific animal here, you know. And that specific animal happens to be tied to a specific religion. So, you know, hey.
Yeah.
And the stupid, contemptuous, decaying dead body, I'm pretty sure, is the zombie Jesus there, which I find just humorous. I mean, at least to me, that's what it means. So I could be wrong about that, but pretty sure that's what it means.
Yeah, that's a comedy there. Yeah. So the whole process is just fun, and it's if you're willing to invest the time, if you go from willing to invest the time to wanting to invest the time to an enjoying investing time. I think you told your wife the other day, Kirk, that it's a good day when I've been in the Word and worked out some translations, and it's been a bad day when I haven't.
Yeah, well, that's pretty much true. I enjoy
there
that
you
for,
go.
The, for the week.
That's well, you guys are addicts. And
we are
to me, it's a good
we
day when I learn. to me, it's a good day when I
hear. We are hooked on it. We are absolutely hooked on it. And to go cold, to go cold turkey on it would be devastating to us. I'm not sure I could even
to any of us. I don't do translations, but what I'm interested in doing is tying things together, put them in notes, put them all together. One thing I can tell you is that from start to finish, there's not one translation I've laid out there, okay? Maybe, as you said, they didn't go deep enough, but they never contradict one another. You look at a religious writings in the Bible, and they're totally contradictory all over the place.
Right.
Everywhere.
All over the place. Yeah, like the
yes, they are.
The commandment, honor your father and mother, right after fathers corrupt their children.
Away from, yeah, but we're down here walking away from dad in Babylon as Kirk points out. I mean, see, there you got two right there. Then
I'm of the, I have a view of Yahweh that is that I would not encourage anyone else to embrace. It is mine. It works for me. I'm comfortable with it, but I'm not trying to sell it to anybody. But my view of Yahweh is that he doesn't want us to be impressed with him. He just wants us to enjoy our relationships. I don't put God on a pedestal. I most certainly don't worship. I'm real comfy with him. There's nothing in our relationship that is anything other than close and
familial.
Familial. Mm-hmm. Very familial. Very
that's
close.
The way families are.
We're comfortable.
I had a person tell me they believed in free will, all while claiming Yahweh makes commands.
That's why I told her words mean things. Yahweh loved Dode, and yet Dode had all sorts of imperfections. So I don't even worry about my imperfections around God. I'm just really comfortable in our relationship together. And so when you get to that place, you just want to spend time together learning.
Nothing other than that is that
I'm comfortable in his presence. I enjoy being around him, and the best way to be around him and to enjoy the relationship is to look at what he said.
Mm-hmm.
So I do it from a real, just super, super comfortable, relaxed.
Well, you are comfortable with it. You should be. But that's clear. I mean, you have some real good insights, and you make good connections, and you make them every week now. And
I'm just comfortable in the material. I'm comfortable around him. I'm comfortable in his Torah. I think that's what he wants. Whether or not I pushed it to an extreme, I probably have. But that's where I'm comfortable. I have to use that word again.
I don't know that you can get that extreme. There's people, they might find your position, our position, all of us really here, extreme in that we understand observing the Torah, not obeying commands. I mean, that, I don't know how extreme that is. That's called realistic.
Observing, use your eyes, your faculty of sight, to consider what is available. And if you're observing the Torah, you're reading it. So that's all the word means. Now there's some subtle connotations about closely examining and carefully considering, but on the surface, the word just means to look at.
Yeah, you're observing. I should be processing information too.
Right.
I'm just amazed at the amount of people that can't process.
There's
people out there that simply can't process. I mean, a lot of people.
Well, I didn't translate much this week, but I certainly read a lot. I read 7 and 8 because I was working on 6 the previous
day. Eight is really pretty cool, isn't it?
It was pretty cool.
That's pretty cool.
All over the side saying, wow, that a lot of wow.
That's pretty cool, man.
That's cool. That's cool.
Yeah, it is. I'm still going through it.
So, oh, man. Yeah,
I like to read
them
two or three times.
I'm
going to go walk my dog.
Thought here.
Great show.
We've said a lot of positive things about some of these translations and some of this stuff. Realize that the reason this stuff is interesting and the reason it's fun and the reason it's edifying and all that is simply because of the actual content of the material that has been conveyed to us is spectacular. we are not creating anything here. All we're doing is reporting. What we're reporting on is so far beyond anything that man has ever conceived. That's what makes it so spectacular. It's the actual content of what's being said.
Yeah, and you know what? I hate to say it again. We're looking at words that haven't been considered from their base roots with their real meanings for thousands of years. And by the way, we're handing people that water. We're giving it to them. We're giving them a big drink. And that's huge, isn't it? I mean, it's huge.
Yeah.
To be fair,
I think that when Yosha was talking to the people, obviously his presentation of this material was vastly superior to what we're doing right now. So I said, obviously I was wrong there.
There's an exception there.
Yeah, Yosha's presentation of this material was...
the walking Torah would know.
We're doing now, there was a difference in that while he communicated orally to those people then, and while we have snippets of it, although in a wrong language, and we can, you know, appreciate it when we see it from the right perspective, are the tools that we have available today to consider the material that Yosha was actually quoting from, which is the Torah, Prophets and Psalms, are so much better. And we, with these tools, I think we're in a position to understand what Yosha was saying vastly better than what his audience was able to do. Even though he was a billion times better communicator of this material and understood it vastly better than we will on this side of our transformation into eternity. The fact of the matter is that we're able to understand and benefit from what he said far more than his audience was at that time.
By far.
By far.
Absolutely.
Yeah, it's not close.
Well, J.D. Larry... NCW, appreciate it immensely. I got to go, though.
Yeah, all right, Captain Kirk.
All right, Kirk.
Are we doing anything other than next Friday?
I think we are. We'll find out from, later. I don't know. And I don't know what my schedule is going to be next Friday. But I hope to go down and see my son and the People's Republic of Texas on Friday. We'll see if that transpires. So, you know, I may need a rain check if I'm flying at that time. I don't know what time I'm going to leave, what time I'm going to get there, but I'll know more.
Let me know if you need me.
I'll know more later on, and so we'll just play it by ear. I just don't know at this point. When it comes to
does anybody know if the Turkish coup failed or not?
I just read an article, and I don't know the answer to the question. Is I really don't know. My hope would be that the military would prevail. Now, I think Erdogan is easily one of the most dangerous men in the world today. But the difficulty in the military prevailing is that Erdogan did not act in the vacuum. Erdogan took Turkey to make it a fundamentalist Islamic state over the past 10 years because the overwhelming preponderance of that country was fundamentalist Muslim and supported him. And so now a military coup to take the country back to its original Turkish roots, which was to be more secular, is difficult because I think that the numbers now in Turkey are somewhere around 80-20. I think 80% of Turks now are fundamentalist Muslims, and 20% would consider themselves more secular. And so that's going to make it much more difficult for the military to prevail in a coup. So that's my thought here. I don't know the question, the answer to the question. And it's one of those things where I have no influence over. My hope is therefore, you know, quite different.
Yeah, well, you know, it's saying it was a failed coup attempt is what I'm looking at. And what that's going to do really is pave the way for him to drag more Islam in. That's what it's going to do.
Of course. If it fails,
supposedly. Yeah.
I've
went through four articles that are saying it.
Yeah, it was right before the show is when I saw the first article on it, and I haven't read anything since. So, you know, I don't know. I would tell you that I think that the likelihood of it prevailing because of what has transpired over the last 10 years in Turkey is it would be extraordinarily difficult. If they wanted to do this, I think they waited at least 5 years too long, maybe 10 years too long.
It says here, increasingly, the coup attempt seems to have been planned by Erdogan, because that's how far it'll strengthen him. It may. I don't know.
That's absolutely possible.
I mean,
a failed coup attempt would be perfect for Erdogan to create a perception of potential anarchy. To have complete and dictatorial, can you say, caliph powers. Erdogan's single biggest disappointment is the rise of the Islamic State, with Baghdadi claiming to be the caliph to unite the Sunni Muslim world. Because guess what Erdogan wants to be?
The man.
He wants to be the caliph.
The caliph. That is correct.
Yeah.
That is correct.
Yeah.
And by the way, if the Islamic State eventually fails, we'll make it.
He still has a shot.
Fundamentalist Islam. He still has a shot.
Hmm.
But it's also interesting that Erdogan just reinitialized relations with Israel.
Strange.
Yeah, I know. And he was the one on the warpath against Israel. So, you know, the whole thing is just so bizarre that I'm just glad I'm no longer doing the Shattering Myths show. I can be fascinated by it, and I can share a little bit here and there. You know, if y'all want to talk about it for a few minutes at the beginning of the shows, but you know,
I think
we know where it's going. We know how fast it's going to disintegrate, and so.
Let's enjoy
the time
we
have. Why don't we enjoy family? You know, we'll leave a bigger reservoir